We try to run a RASi framework. It's an acronym for like recommender, approver, consulter, consulted, and informed. So for bigger things, we'll write it out and say, okay, this person's a recommender, this person's the approver. Here's a list of people who need to be consulted because they have input or it affects them. And, you know, okay, we'll keep the other people informed. And especially as we're, you know, a bigger company where a lot of people need to be involved and you need more process and structure, it helps sort of make things efficient for executives who don't have as much time.
Welcome to the Super Managers Podcast, where we interview leaders from all walks of life to tease out the habits, thought patterns, learnings, and experiences that help them be extraordinary at the fine craft of management. Our goal is to bring you the lessons and the insights so that you don't have to learn through your own mistakes, but so that you can shortcut your way to being a great leader. This podcast is brought to you by Fello, a software platform that helps managers and their teams work better together. Check it out at www.fello.app. Hey, fellow managers and leaders, I'm Aiden, and I'm the CEO of Fello.app. Today, I'm excited to share with you a conversation I had with Sam Zaid, the co-founder and CEO of GetAround, a company that has raised over $400 million in venture capital from top investors. Prior to GetAround, Sam founded Aption, an enterprise software consultancy, and 360PI, the retail price intelligence platform that was acquired by MarketTrack and Vista Equity in 2016. Sam holds numerous patents and inventions. He's an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, a Microsoft Code Award winner, and a Goldman Sachs Most Intriguing Entrepreneur. He studied engineering physics at Queen's University and is a graduate of NASA Ames, where he received the Google Scholarship. In this episode, we talk to Sam about how leadership styles change as people move up in an organization, all the way from individual contributor to manager to CEO, and we dive into the playbook that Sam uses to identify and hire great leaders. We also discuss the RASi framework and how GetAround is using this and another set of rituals to help new managers be effective right away. So without further ado, here's Sam Zaid on another episode of the Super Managers Podcast. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Aiden. I'm glad to be here.
I've been really looking forward to this. Obviously, you and I have known each other for quite some time.
Yeah, a couple of weeks, a couple of years.
a couple of years, decades, maybe, yeah. Something like that.
Right.
This is super fun for me just because, you know, I've obviously seen what you've done over your career or across a bunch of different companies. And actually even had the pleasure of working with you on a project where we sold suits online.
Yeah, I think we're still number one on Google, right?
Yeah. Search rankings still have not declined. Yeah. But I guess one of the questions that I wanted to just kick things off with, when did you, who was your first boss? Like, who would you consider like the first manager that you reported to?
Yeah. I haven't had that many
right.
non-entrepreneurial jobs.
Right.
So I can select from a limited, you know, set. But the first one that comes to mind, first manager I ever had, and he was a great manager. It was but I was very young. So it was when I first started working at Nortel, which obviously is a company that doesn't exist anymore. But I started working there I think I was around 14 when I first started working there.
Holy moly, why did they let you work there at 14? That's a different question.
They were obviously it was like a massive time when the company was growing a lot. Early internet. They did a program where they were doing like internships.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part of that story is I was actually trying to get a job at a grocery store and they wouldn't hire me. But I was, you know, I got lucky and found a manager at Nortel who hired me. So I'd worked there part-time and then full-time in summers. And I was like, you know, writing code, learning computer stuff. And, you know, a couple things. Well, aside from it being, you know, it was actually my first real work experience as a programmer engineer, which, by the way, I didn't like at all. I had much more to
really?
Enjoy it. Really? Yeah, when it was a hobbyist thing, I enjoyed it much more. But that's probably topic for a different podcast.
Right.
But I was coming back to your question about, he was a great manager because like he just was very encouraging. He gave me like open-ended problems. Like, hey, go to the, like my first project was, hey, go, here's a system we have. We want you to write a demo of it that functionally replicates it on a PC, so we can show it to customers without having to, you know, ship a whole transport system to them. You know, so I ended up writing that. You know, at the time I was doing a lot of other languages, but I think I ended up writing like HyperCard or something, which was like, you probably don't even remember what
that
was.
I don't even know what that is.
But anyway, he would go through my code and give me pointers, and he was like, just, you know, always very encouraging, would give me a lot of freedom, room to make mistakes. I remember I would comment my code. I didn't really even know what commenting was at the time. I just sort of did it. And he was like, hey, this is really good. This is like what I like to see. And like, you know, and, you know, was, you know, very encouraging, but then also give good constructive feedback.
Right.
And I had another manager after him who had a very different style. So I had a real contrast, and it was like completely affected my motivation, actually.
Oh, what did the other person do?
I just felt like he never was really happy with, like, he cared more about, less about the quality of my work, more about like when I showed up, when I left, exactly what I was. It was much more like,
right.
You know, he was much more of
a micromanager, maybe.
So people use throw around micromanager, and it wasn't that he was telling me exactly what to do all the time, but it was more that, you know, I think he was very, he had just a certain way of doing things, and he wanted me to work that way, sort of, so that I fit his mold entirely. And some of those things was great, and it was good discipline, but other stuff, you know, just didn't make sense for what I was doing. And then the other one was, I think he didn't really give me when I came in my first manager, he was like, hey, go do this thing. And it was like, you know, wasn't the most important project going on, but it was like something that went to customers and, you know, I got to work on, and he gave me an opportunity and, you know, sort of room to execute. Whereas the manager I had after that was also good, but he was more worried about me as like, okay, well, he's an intern, he has this thing, so I'll put him on this or that, and sort of gave me all the jobs nobody really wanted. So I didn't mind. I mean, it was good learning either way, and it was better than bagging groceries, so I wasn't complaining, but, you know, it was just a difference in mentality.
Right. And so I assume that this had some sort of impact on your leadership style. So how would you describe, or rather, if I asked your team, how would they describe your leadership style?
Yeah, I don't know. You have to ask them. Yeah, I would say that I try to be, do a few things. So one is I try to be very like empathetic, down to earth, matter of fact. I want to work with my team, empower them. You know, things I enjoy is, I mean, I enjoy seeing people, you know, even at times when they think that there's a challenge or a problem that they don't really feel comfortable or don't feel they're ready for. I've seen many times people just surprise themselves and surprise people around them and just deliver just such excellent work. So I'd say my management style is really, you know, just trying to, you know, get shit done, focus on solving problems, helping people, being a partner, and then, you know, letting them sort of take the reins and go. And obviously that requires selecting for the right sort of people on your team that you can do that with. But, you know, it's what I've learned.
Cool. And so do you find, I mean, so Getter, you know, you've obviously been at a bunch of different companies now, mm-hmm. or started a bunch of different companies. Sure. Do you find that, like, is Sam the leader today? How is he different than, you know, the previous companies, or even in like the earlier stages of Get Around? Like, do you think that your style or your approach or what you do has evolved?
So definitely has evolved. And also, you know, first of all, it changes with stage of company, right? You know, like obviously when you're a small startup, you have to be, you know, much more in the weeds. I would say in general that, you know, I feel like where I ask for I try to be very clear as to what I ask for out of people on my team. And I like to know that they have command of their respective domains. And as long as they do, that gives me comfort. But a lot has evolved, right? Like I think when we were a smaller company, or even when I was starting my other companies, it was much more like do everything, right? Figure out what the priorities are for the day, because there's probably 100 and you can do 5 of them. Figure out how to get those done and work very, very collaboratively with the team. And it's a very much more unstructured process. Obviously, as we scale the company, things become much more structured. And so you know, then it's more about hiring leaders that can really, you know, clearly build an organization, can lead, have, you know, be very clear communicators, drive organizational clarity, empower the teams below them. You know, certainly people who enjoy and, you know, really enjoy building teams and people and organizations and are, you know, very strong people managers matters a lot more than, you know, when you're a smaller company, you can have a lot of domain experts and functional leaders and that works really well. So I would say that's one thing. And then also managing in the Bay Area is very different than, you know, say in Canada. It's just a different, there's a different set of expectations, different level of competition. There's much, much more, you know, recruiting competition and, you know, retention is a much bigger challenge.
So you think the bar has to be higher here?
Definitely higher here. Yeah, because there's so much, I mean, there's always people getting offers and other opportunities and there's so many startups funded every single day. And then, you know, you have the Google, the Facebooks, the Apples and all those companies are always, you know, put out a job offer that's valid for a year. It's so like, you know, there's just a lot. It's just a different, I think a much more competitive environment, which in many ways is good because it really keeps the companies honest, right? Because you have to retain people because you have to retain them because they have other options because the market is so efficient and so fluid. Whereas, you know, other parts of the world, there's not that many options for folks. So as long as they have a job, they're sort of happy. And the benefit of that is they probably expect less. So I think learning how to operate in that environment when I first, certainly when I first started Get Around was definitely, you know, something very new, sort of a rude awakening.
Yeah. And so this is one of the reasons I love, you know, coming here and chatting with people here. I do feel that it's in some ways a more evolved ecosystem for work. And you're right. So if the bar is higher, I mean, managers just have to perform at like that other, you know, at a different level so that their team actually enjoys working with them. And yeah, you can't, like if you're a crappy boss, basically people will leave to that year-long offer that they have from that next company. You know, one of the things that I've heard you say in the past, and I can kind of get that, you know, from what you've been saying right now, which is that the most important thing that you can do, especially in, you know, scaling company like Get Around, is make sure that you hire great leaders. I remember in the context of, I was asking you maybe a question of, you know, how do you encourage more feedback at your company or something on this level? And then you said, no, you see, you're asking the wrong question. Like the right question is, how do you get the best leaders on board?
Yeah. I don't remember the context why you were asking me about the feedback. You know, I've grown to appreciate the benefit of having really strong leaders. I think it drastically impacts people's motivation and belief and passion for a company. And that obviously ultimately affects their willingness to work and what they do. And then the other thing really is, you know, making sure that those leaders themselves can work as a team. And because like, you know, at the end of the day, especially in today's world, you know, and certainly at Get Around, everything is so cross-functional that like we need our teams working together. And when they do, they, you know, come up with these magical solutions to things. Whereas, you know, if it's just one department or another, they're sort of limited in what they can do, what things they can impact. But obviously that starts at the executive ranks, right? And so if the executives aren't a team, the rest of the company will never be a team. So, you know, bringing leaders that are here to play a team game and really put the companies first, put their team second and themselves last, and make sure the priority order is always company, team, self, super critical. And as soon as you have one person who changes that order or sets a different, you know, rank order of priorities for their department, then you start to see these sort of like politics and teams being isolated and people not communicating well and duplicative work and confusion and all those things that like you really don't want. And probably as a CEO, you're like, what? Why is this going on?
Yeah. So I guess they're kind of like the symptoms and you may try and solve like an individual symptom, but like the reality is the problem just stems from the leadership. So I guess my,
yeah, I mean, either from the CEO or from the, you know, the top executives.
So I guess my question, and this is like super tactical. So since you appreciate like hiring these great leaders so much, what is your playbook basically? Like, how do you know that someone would actually be great at leading a team?
Yeah.
How do you know that they're going to fit into like the rest of your leadership team
yeah.
and that they put the company and then the team and then self?
Yeah. So, well, first I'll say we've made mistakes for sure. and there's no, you know, I think it's like, you know, probably if your batting average is better than, I don't know, 1 in 2 or 2 out of 3, like that's pretty freaking good.
Okay. So I just wanted to know, because like for the audience, is the bar 2 out of 3? Is that?
I'd have to do the math. Right. I don't know. I mean, it's, and it depends when you measure it. Certainly, you know, so was the question was, how do you know? So I can tell you what we've done, but so the way I think about it is, you know, if I'm an executive, what is my team looking to me for? Right. They're looking for leadership. They're looking for guidance. They're looking for sort of everything that's in a good people manager. They're probably also looking for someone that understands the type of work they do, what they do, why they do it, how to improve them as a professional. Right. And so certainly at the executive layer, depending on how many, you know, what layer of executive we're talking about, there's a challenge of finding somebody who can sort of do both of those things, right? Be a great leader, but also be some level of functional leader or expert. So we look for people who, and then people who know how to build an organization, right? So, you know, you can be a functional expert, a great leader, but still not know how to, you know, build a team or build an arc. So we have a bunch of cultural values. So things we test for are one we call ability, like, or what we call is our hashtag, which is hashtag build engines. So an ability to build systems inside the company so that, you know, if they were to leave, everything still runs with an objective of they shouldn't be necessary, right? Another thing we test for is, you know, an ability to get under the hood, meaning they can get in and figure out why something's not working and when they need to, not necessarily all the time. But, you know, if they don't understand sort of the root cause of why something isn't working, then how do they bring that to the executive team in a way that everybody can collaborate and figure out what the right answer is? So we've always tested for that. The things we haven't always tested for where we've, you know, maybe gone wrong in the past is what I mentioned, the company team self. I think especially around here where there's a lot of opportunity, and I'll say a lot of ego, you can get people who bring in, set the priorities differently,
mm-hmm.
right? And especially if they're, you know, things, times get challenging, you can see those priorities change. So that's something we're...
So tactically speaking, like what kind of questions would you ask during an interview to
It's hard because it's a character thing, right? But I think generally it's people who don't have a lot of ego and have a lot of humility. So like I'd say is like, for me, I'm like, how do I identify Peter Parkers, right? Because Peter Parker is... You know, well, you know, what the sort of the saying, it's like, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And so obviously he's got a lot of great power, but also acts in a way that's very responsible. But he's also the type of guy that's never arrogant or overconfident. And in fact, doubts himself a lot of the time, but still will confront major challenges. And so look for sort of that type of a person because they'll play a team game. Right. And they'll put the company first. They'll put the team ahead of themselves. And, you know, that's sort of the archetype, but that's a personality trait and a character thing. Less of, you know, it's less about any sort of formal management training or functional domain expertise.
Cool. That makes sense. One of the things that I've always known about you as well is just your focus on operational rigor and just, you know, operational excellence.
Sure.
In general. And so I know that you, like you have a...
I can overdo that at times.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, like, what is your management almost like stack? And what I mean by that is like, let's say we parachute you into like a team. What are the sets of rituals that you would first ask, do they exist? And if not, create them right away.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's interesting. But some of the things we do, for instance, is, okay, like, what is the rhythm of the business, right? Like, Are we reporting stuff daily? Are we reporting stuff weekly? Who's owning what? Like really being clear about the organizational design, the, you know, any sort of matrix organization and like how you're, you know, whether it's like, you know, a squad model or a Spotify model or whatever. So just really being clear about organization and then understanding the cadence of what's happening and how things flow, how information flows. So everyone is aware of it, right? So I know, okay, I'm gonna have this update on this particular day. So I don't have to ever ask for it ahead of that. And if it doesn't happen, then someone will ask for it, but you know, there's an expectation. That also drives accountability and ownership because then people have to report things. And so it means things have to get done and have to move. So sort of the cadence or rhythm of the business, how you think about that. And then I like to set my priorities. So I just keep my own sort of like, what are the things I care about to getting done today, tomorrow, next day? You know, obviously some days that doesn't always work as planned because things happen, but sort of being clear on what, you know, what are the 1, 2, 3 deliverables you're trying to get out in a single day. But yeah, so with the management thing, I would think it's very important to, so we do think, so rhythm of the business, how do the communication channels happen, clarity of organizational design and accountability and ownership. Those are all very, I mean, everyone should know that stuff. Other stuff we do is we do mission decks. So this is
what's a mission deck?
So mission deck is we have a company mission. We have our corporate, you know, sort of like what's the mission of the company. But then imagine you're in a team and you're, let's say you're in a trust and safety team. You're running trust and safety at GetAround. What is your mission? And so our mission decks are an opportunity for a team, smaller group, to craft what, you know, is their mission. So they have something they can say, hey, this is what we do. We are going to provide delightful, real time and very balanced trust and safety. I just made something up, right?
But right.
Sure. And then, okay, how are we going to do that? Here are the strategies we're going to employ. Here are the KPIs and things we're going to measure. Here's how ownership and responsibility is designed within our team. And here's the blind spots and things that like we think by executing this strategy might be sort of, you know, side effects that we need to be worried about or need to at least mitigate. And like every team does that and publishes it out to the whole company. So then you can see, okay, what does that team do? Well, here's their mission. Here's what they believe in.
So it's almost like they're their own
company.
It has
to roll up to the whole company.
Right.
Yeah, but so it gives them a purpose, like, you know, a raison d'être, right? And mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, we've done it and we're doing a whole pass on it right now again. And, you know, just it's cool when people anchor on that because then they feel like they've got, you know, the mission of the company, which they understand, but then they have the mission, their mission, which helps drive the company's mission. And that's much more tangible to them, right? Because it's what they do every day.
Yeah. That's really interesting because I've heard of that in the context of things like OKRs, but this sounds like a more perpetual thing of like,
yeah, it's longer lasting than OKRs. We do OKRs as well, but okay. So we do OKRs and health metrics are just, it's the same as when you go to a doctor and you get a checkup and make sure your blood pressure is in the right, you know, range and stuff like this. But then the OKRs are things you're trying to move, right? So the way we think about it is, okay, well, if I have high blood pressure and I want to bring it down, my OKR is to bring it down. And then, you know, that's, I'm going to bring it down by 20% this quarter. So then an OKR is really something that moves a health metric for the business, but that's quarterly and monthly and can change. Whereas your mission is more strategic, longer running. It's about sort of, you know, what you're really, it's more qualitative. It does include health metrics as well, obviously the KPIs, but.
Do you also include the way in which, because again, if you're talking about this as this team or this department or organization being kind of its own structure,
yeah.
Do you also define in that like how you're going to, like the SLAs you might have with other departments or areas in
yeah,
the company?
Yeah, so when I said KPIs, we think of those as what are those key metrics, call them health metrics for that team. That could be servicing a customer. So it could be like customer satisfaction. It could be for a legal department, you know, like document turnaround time or something. I mean, they're servicing an internal customer and they define them themselves, right? And obviously you may not get it right the first time, but it's like a process where they can learn and then codify what they've learned. And someone else can look at it, an executive can look at it, but it drives empowerment and ownership. And so once they've defined their health metrics, then an OKR is really a, oh, we have a health metric where we're turning around documents in 7 days and we want to drive that to 3 days. So our OKR for the quarter is to make a delta, to drive a delta in this health metric. And so the OKRs is only ever a smaller subset of sort of like the health metrics and core KPIs that a team looks at. And they're monitoring them all the time, but they're focusing on a small set that where they want to make sort of some sort of change or improvement.
Got it.
That's how we differentiate like a key result is really an improvement to a health metric versus the thing you just look at to know sort of how you're doing overall, make sure something's not going off track.
Cool. That makes sense. Switching topics for a little bit, I remember you telling me about some of the things that you do in order to run your meetings. There's a specific scenario that you said that, I mean, I don't know how true this is.
I'm listening.
Yeah, which is you actually had a timer for specific topics that you talked about during meetings. And literally when the timer goes off, you must switch to the next topic.
Yeah, we're not that militant, but so I would say that, and you know, you can't always enforce it perfectly, but you know, I try to set guidelines for my EA, for example. She books a meeting. I want to have an agenda. Okay, so just, you know, like what are we talking about? When I put together agendas like for meetings I'm driving that are, you know, important, they might be longer meetings with a partner or something. I try to set that agenda and then I put like, you know, increments of 15 minutes against each one. So something might be, you know, maybe even increments of 5 minutes, actually. Intro might be 5 minutes. Then maybe there's this opening thing, 15 minutes. And then there's core of the meeting, which is a 30-minute agendas or items or something. So at least then we know, you know, how much time we're expecting to spend up front. And then as we're going through, we can see, oh, we're here. And like, you know, we've spent 20 minutes, you know, but we're only 10 minutes through the agenda. I find that's helpful. It also is a reminder for me because I can engage in conversation and get into a meeting, then, you know, next thing you know, time's gone, right? Also my chief of staff is very good at keeping us on track. So before I had a chief of staff, I used a timer that was linked to my iPhone. So I could just like, you know, put a digital display out in the meeting room. But, don't do that as much right now.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So what would you say to people that would say, well, if you have that much of a regimented sort of like agenda, then where's the room for, say, creativity and brainstorming? And like, what if a really important thing comes up that's more important than everything else that was going to be discussed?
Yeah, I mean, we're not radicalists. I mean, like, you know, you have to apply judgment, right? Which is important in any meeting. But I think also you have to understand the type of meeting you're in, right? Are you in a decision-making meeting? Are you in an informational meeting? Are you in a strategic, sort of like very strategic meeting? Or is it more of a brainstorming meeting, right? Depending on what it is, you set the agenda, but even a brainstorming meeting, like, one of my first creative directors always used to say, like, there's no creativity without constraint, right? So, you know, if you have all day to brainstorm, you'll probably, you know, brainstorm all day. But if you say, hey, we're going to spend 90 minutes or 45 minutes, then you have to focus your energy on, you know, living within that constraint, which allows you to focus your creativity as well. So, so I think it's just different, right? It doesn't have to be like, okay, we're going to brainstorm for 5.5 minutes. It's maybe a little bit more loose if it's a brainstorming meeting than if it's, hey, we're trying to drive at 3 decisions. We have all the decision documents sort of prepared ahead of time. People have reviewed them. And so then we're just like 15 minutes on this one, 15 on this, 15 on this. I mean, that's another thing we do is if we're driving at decisions, we try to write things down, right? So someone takes ownership of recommending it. They write a decision document. It gets funneled to everyone. Everyone reviews it ahead of time, come to the meeting, spend 15 minutes, you know, on it, or maybe whatever amount of time, and then have a decision at the end of it. So there's a lot less sort of like fluid stuff happening in the meeting and people come prepared. And if people haven't read it, you know, my chief of staff will ask, hey, has everyone read this? And if you don't, you put your hand up and we say, okay, fine. Everyone spend 5 minutes. Let's read it because there's no point coming to the meeting if you haven't read it. And then we start the meeting.
Cool. No, I really like that. And do you, in advance decide who the decision maker is, or what if it's like
so
close?
We try to run a RASi framework. So it's like a, I have to remember what all the acronyms are. So it's an acronym for like recommender, approver, consult, someone who's like a consultant or consulted, and informed. So I guess it really means, so like you have the recommender or the person who's recommending the decision. You have the approvers, basically ultimately the decision maker. You have the people who are consulted, and then you have the people who are just informed, right? And so for bigger things, we'll write it out and say, okay, this person's a recommender, this person's the approver. Here's a list of people who need to be consulted because they have input or it affects them. And, you know, okay, we'll keep the other people informed. So then when that's really clear, then the person who's a recommender can go away, get the information, put it in a document that we have a standard format for, send out the decision doc, and then you can drive an effective decision meeting. And especially as we're, you know, a bigger company where a lot of people need to be involved and you need more process and structure, it helps sort of make things efficient for definitely for executives who don't have so much time to be, you know, they get all the information and the detail. They can choose how much they want to like internalize that, but they don't have to go and get it themselves.
Right. And so this template that you have, like where does that live? Is that a sort of thing that when new managers
are going to be a new feature in Fellow?
You know, we do have cool templates in Fellow, but no, I'm just curious, like, is it like by osmosis that like people sit in a meeting and like, this is the way that we do things at GetAround?
Yeah. I mean, this is, first of all, it's evolved, right? It's stuff. Some of these things are things we've only added in the last 6 months, but the, what was the question? Where they left?
Do you operationalize this so that all decision meetings or like important ones across GetAround actually work that way?
Yeah. I mean, it's really about being disciplined to not have the meeting if that hasn't happened. And so rather than just, people often lead by booking meetings, right? So let's book a meeting. That's the first thing that happens. And so rather than doing that, it might be, okay, let's have whoever's involved talk about, you know, who's responsible? Who's going to be the ultimate decision maker and approver, and who's going to recommend the solution? Okay. Once that's agreed, then it's like, okay, let's go get that done and then book a meeting. Or you can book the meeting in advance, but have a meeting to go through that, and not have the meeting without that tool for people to have gotten the decision document ahead of time.
Cool.
Now for small decisions, you don't do that, but for a lot of stuff where you're deciding on, hey, should we do this with this sort of, you know, product direction or this sort of partner or, you know, I don't know, this sort of lunch plan, like whatever it is. Because also having the document means someone can come in later, go back and be like, here's the options were considered. Here's the recommended option. And here's the reasons why. And here's the decision that's ultimately made and who made it. Right. And so that gets really clear in that document so that, you know, you don't lose that institutional memory when somebody leaves or somebody forgets. And for us, those are currently all just like Google Doc templates. Mm-hmm. So nothing fancy about them. But
yeah. But I think it's really interesting because like, yes, it's institutional memory, but I suppose like it's also a way that you can actually learn and get better with decisions because you can actually go and revisit what the thought process was back then.
Yeah, it also drives discipline, right? Because people know they have to do it. And I had dinner maybe nine months ago now, with Stephen Harper, who, you know, is former Prime Minister of Canada. And I didn't know much about him, actually. But one thing that was interesting is his leadership style was always about, like, I want everything written down. So that, because some people are not like that. Some people have a leadership style where it's just like, you know, let's just have a quick conversation, make the decision. But then if you're making so many decisions in a given day or week, it's pretty easy to, you know, forget, or really hard to keep track of that. And so he had this structure where all of his aides would make sure everything was given in a packet so that, you know, he could get as much detail, but didn't have to, you know, but could make effective decisions, and everything was codified and written. And I think writing it down just gives you a different level of discipline. It's harder to wing it. Like you know, when you're writing something, there's more clarity and structure, and people have time to reflect before they put words on a page, which is different than unstructured session where, like, I would never say that that's effective for brainstorming, right? You're not going to write a decision doc for brainstorming, but, you know, if someone's going to take ownership over, hey, are we going to move offices? And here's the three choices. And like, here's the recommended option and here's why. And there's budget impacts and time and location and travel and employee, you know, morale, all that type of stuff. You sort of want somebody to really do put some thought and discipline behind that.
Yeah.
Type of decision.
No, that's awesome. That sounds great. We should probably start doing that at Fellow. This is super helpful. We've talked about a lot of things, hiring leaders, operationalizing things, the RASi framework. And by the way, all of these will be in the show notes.
Yeah.
Just wanted to end on a just more a fun note. So for all the aspiring managers and leaders out there that want to get better at their craft, any kind of resources, recommendations that like you would have for them over the next year that they should think about?
Yeah. So it's a good question to end on. So I guess there's like, obviously the classic books people can read. So, you know, there's like, you know, Good to Great, Contrarian's Guide to Leadership, Radical Candor, Five Dysfunctions of a Team, probably all the stuff you've already read. I find for me personally, there's a certain point after reading books that thematically, I don't know that I get that much from them. Sort of different twists on the same themes. but you know, if you haven't read those, you should read them. That's probably a good starting point. I think the other is putting into practice and hiring leaders who are better than you, because you can learn from them. And there's a lot of folks who come from great companies and have great, processes and structures and philosophies, and they can bring value, right? And so and a little bit about being a leader is not having ego and letting that happen and realizing like, hey, you're not gonna be the best at everything. So like, just find those people. And then I think the thing I haven't done too much of, but I've heard from a lot of my friends is really helpful is getting like either a good advisory network or an executive coach or people who've, you know, have more perspective than you could ever have. Cause you're always going to be sort of focused on one thing as a founder, CEO, or as a manager and, be willing to get feedback, even if you don't understand why you need it or whether you need it. I think that can be helpful. I think the other thing, look, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but we're setting up a book club internally with all of my executive team so that everyone has to read the same book and then we can like, you know, talk about it. Maybe that has an impact. I'll let you know. I don't know if there's a fast answer.
But I love your hack of like actually, you know, looking to people from other organizations that, and using that as a method to like learn very quickly.
Yeah, I think it's important. I actually think every organization is different, right? Like I think if you named off companies people know, whether it's like Amazon or Facebook or Airbnb, completely different, you know, management styles, cultures, leadership style. So I don't know if there's a right answer, but there's certainly, it's great to sort of maybe take a nugget from each one.
Cool. And that's what we're trying to do on this show. And probably on a good note to end it. Thank you, Sam. This has been awesome.
Awesome. Thanks, Aiden.
And that's it for today. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Super Managers Podcast. You can find the show notes and transcript at www.fellow.app/supermanagers. If you like the content, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe so you can get notified when we post the next episode. And please, tell your friends and fellow managers about it. It'd be awesome if you could help us spread the word about the show. See you next time.